Please take a seat. Let me add my welcome to Deans. My name's Andrew, one of the pastors here, and it's good to see several new faces. I think as almost every week people find us, whether online or invited by friends. So welcome if it's your first time, and I hope you'll have a very warm welcome. Please stay around at the end. As Dean mentioned, there's lots of tea, and we have a cake grater. It's one of my favourite things about this church, and there is some delicious cake, if it's any of it still left. I sampled some earlier. But stay around, introduce yourself, don't hurry off. We'd love to have a chance to meet you. Now, we're in a series going through the book of Romans. We started at chapter 1, verse 1, a year or so ago, and we've been taking it in installments, and we've reached Romans chapter 9, and it would be a great help to me if you could turn to it in your Bible so that you follow along as we go through it together. So it's on page 945. And if you're here for the first time, you've joined us as we hit quite a contentious and controversial couple of paragraphs in the Bible. So it's our practice at Grace Church just to go through verse by verse and leave nothing out. And it happens that this week you've arrived for the controversy. So Paul has just said in verse 18, Romans chapter 9, that it's God's decision who is saved, who he has mercy on, and whom he doesn't, whom he hardens. God decides. Last week we introduced the whole subject of predestination. I called it the Christian P word. It's like the F word, but the Christian equivalent, the word that you're not really supposed to say in polite Christian company. It's controversial, and people struggle with it. And today we pick up the objection. Someone's just heard that God decides who's saved, and they say that can't be fair. And if it is fair, then surely we're just robots. You know, God's just decided and we just pre-programmed to go according to his will. And so therefore, it doesn't matter what we do, does it? So we're right at the heart of a contentious and a difficult passage. And we pick up the argument at verse 19. So page 945, right-hand column, a little bit down, verse 19. You will say to me then, why does he, that's God, why does God still find fault? For who can resist his will? But who are you, O man, to answer back to God? Will what is molded say to its molder, why have you made me like this? Has the potter not no right over the clay to make out of the same lump one vessel for honourable use, and another for dishonorable use? What if God, desiring to show his wrath and to make known his power, has endured with much patience vessels of wrath prepared for destruction, in order to make known the riches of his glory for vessels of mercy which he prepared beforehand for glory? Even us, whom he has called, not only from the Jews, but also from the Gentiles, as indeed he says in Hosea, those who are not my people, I will call my people. And her who was not beloved, I will call beloved. And in the very place where it was said to them, you are not my people, there they will be called sons of the living God. And Isaiah cries out concerning Israel, though the number of the sons of Israel be as the sand of the sea, only a remnant of them will be saved. For the Lord will carry out his sentence upon the earth fully and without delay. And as Isaiah predicted, if the Lord of hosts had not left us offspring, we would have been like Sodom and become like Gomorrah. There we are. That's our task for today, to work through these verses. And it might be, even as you heard them read, you really struggle with them. Maybe you hear the words predestination, you hear the idea that it's God's choice about our eternal destiny, and everything in you objects to that. You rail against it. And you wouldn't be alone. All the way through the history of Christianity, this has been one of the most difficult subjects in the Bible for people to stomach. As I say, it's our practice to work through chapters of the Bible and not to censor it. And so here we are. We've got a whole week for these paragraphs to wrestle with them. But just as we begin, you'll see a little outline on the inside of the service sheet. Just as we begin, I want to warn us against saying one of the most dangerous things I think a Christian can say. And it begins like this: I can't believe in a God who... We find something in the Bible that we don't like, and we say, I can't believe in a God who would do that. I can't believe in a God who would predestine people, some to be saved, and some to be hardened. I refuse to believe in a God who predestines. Now, the reason that's such a dangerous thing to say is we end up dictating to God the kind of God he's allowed to be in order to get our votes. It's a sort of emotional blackmail, isn't it? We're saying to God, look, God, if you want me to believe in you, then you better be acceptable to me. And if you're going to go for this kind of version of yourself, I'm not interested. I can't believe in a God who... The question ought to be, God, what kind of a God are you? And then please help me to trust you. Help me to believe in you. And if there are things about your character that aren't the way that I would have chosen them to be, please help me to see that that's good and to come round to be able to trust you even in spite of that. Just be careful of dictating the terms to God. The question is, what kind of God is he? And we're going to look today at God's power, God's right to decide, verse 18, whom he will have mercy on and whom he will harden. God's absolute power over each of our destinies. And I think the reason that we find that really difficult, I've tried to describe in this little grid. You see there's a table on your handout. Here I think are two possible axes for describing powerful people or rulers, or even God himself. A ruler could either be powerful or they could be weak. That's the first axis. And also, a ruler could either be good or they could be bad. And what I want you to do is to work out which of those four boxes would you most like somebody to be in? Would you most like your God to be in? You see, so you can be either powerful or weak or good or bad, and you can choose one of the four combinations. And why don't you just turn to your neighbor and tell them, I prefer this combination. This is my favorite box of those four. Why don't you just quickly buzz with your neighbor? Okay, let's come back together. And we'll take a show of hands to see which is the most popular. So, who wanted good and powerful? Okay, lots of people. Who wanted, this is unlikely, isn't it? But who wanted bad and powerful? Okay, nobody's going to be that perverse good. Who wanted good and weak? Nobody. Who wants bad and weak? Oh, well, this is going to be an easy sermon. Okay, all of you want God to be good and powerful. I hope we do. I think the reason we're scared of God being powerful is actually that we're scared that he might not be good. As we go around looking at rulers and authorities in the world, sometimes there are bad ones, or at least sometimes there are mixed ones. And so we are very nervous about absolute power in the hands of somebody who's mixed. Certainly the government. I'm quite scared of the government in this country becoming too powerful. I don't want them to have universal power. Why not? Because I'm not convinced that politicians in the United Kingdom will ever be completely good. And if they're not going to be completely good, I'd rather they weren't completely powerful. I think the best box to tick is the good and powerful one. The next best one is the bad and weak one. If you're going to be weak, if you're going to be bad, at least don't have too much power, right? At least you limit your ability to do damage to your citizens. But the combination of a tyrant who's powerful and bad, that's what we're shy of. And our reaction to that, certainly in Western culture, has been to say, I'd be better off ruling myself. I don't trust those in authority. I can see that power is easily abused, so I'd rather they didn't have the power. I'd rather I had the power over my own destiny. I'm fearful of a morally mixed ruler. And I want us to see in this passage that God isn't like that. God has absolutely total power. You might say totalitarian power. But we don't need to fear that, because that power is in the hands of someone who is also good. Good and powerful. And actually, that if you ask the question, who would you most like to be in charge of your destiny? I hope by the end of this we say, well, actually, I would like God to be, and I'd even prefer him to be than it to be me that was in charge of my destiny. I want predestination to be true. I'd like him to decide, because he's good as well as powerful. That's my hope. I think that's Paul's hope as he works through these verses. But the argument has several stages, and I've tried to break it down on the sheet. So point one of the argument, God as the potter has the right to mould our destiny, whether that be for destruction or for glory. So he's just said, verse 18, God chooses, God picks who he's merciful to, God picks who he hardens. And then this is the objection, verse 19. Well, why does he find fault? This isn't fair. This is ridiculous. We're just robots. And Paul warns us at this point and becomes quite stern. Who are you, O man, to answer back to God? Will what is molded say to its molder, why have you made me like this? Has the potter no right over the clay to make out of the same lump one vessel for honourable use and another for dishonourable use? Now, it's a very powerful image and not a very flattering one at first. So imagine a piece of a pottery. I made one at school, and I no longer own it, which is not really such a bad thing. It was a bird, and it was basically, I just went like this with my hands to make a block of thing. I attached a tail on the end and then put in two eyes, and that was my, you know, that was about my artistic level, age 10. And then even then, the tail snapped off. So the one thing that I was trying to do, I got wrong. But at least that bird, it was the shape that I sort of wanted it to be. Can you imagine this? It is a slightly surreal analogy, but can you imagine this little pottery bird made by Andrew, age 10, one day saying, I'm a bit annoyed that my tail is so at such a stupid angle. I'd like it to be at a steeper angle. And I would, instead of having my eyes so close together, so I like a slightly scary bird, I'd like my eyes a proper bird's distance apart. I mean, it is almost surreal, isn't it? You have to imagine a surrealist film. But if your clay bird started telling you how you should have made it, that would be a very odd kind of universe. Because this is a bit of clay. And obviously, the shape of the bit of clay is decided by the person who made the bit of clay, obviously. Be a strange lawsuit, wouldn't it? I've just moved into near the part near Maze Hill, and apparently there's a pottery there. I don't know if anyone's been to Maze Hill Pottery. I've seen the sign to it. It looks quite fun. Be quite a bizarre lawsuit, wouldn't it? The case of the Maze Hill pots against their maker, and all the pots on the shelf, you know, hire a lawyer. And they go, I mean, it's a ridiculous scenario. And Paul says, wake up, this is absurd. You're the pots, and you think you can tell the potter how he should have made you. It's ridiculous. Of course the potter can choose a jug, a bird, a plate, a doorstop, whatever else you make out of clay. He gets the right. Now, I say it's not a very flattering analogy, is it? Because he picks as the analogy for God a potter. That's a pretty nice analogy. God's a creative workman. He picks as the analogy of us a bit of clay. And I think that's less flattering. Because in this whole area of destiny, I want to say, I'm a human being. I've got a voice. God should listen to what I want to say. And Paul says, don't get above yourself. You are the clay in the hands of the potter. And he has the right to choose your destiny. Julia, I thought, put it out very clearly in the kids' talk today. God made the Grand Canyon. God owns the Grand Canyon. God made me. God owns me. God decided that I'd be 6'2" and shrinking. I'm probably 6'1" now. You get shorter, don't you, through your life. God decided that I'd have greeny kind of hazel eyes. And it would be odd, wouldn't it, if I were to say, oh, I've decided to be 7'2". Well, no, bad luck. You're 6'2", because God chose that. I want to have blue eyes. Well, I could get weird contact lenses. They're always slightly too blue, aren't they? But no, I've got hazel eyes. And God's decided everything about me. Of course he has, because God made me. Point one. God, as the potter, has the right. But here's the problem. We then imagine this potter shop where God is making human beings, and he goes like this. One for heaven, one for hell. One for hell, one for hell. One for heaven, one for hell. And as if he's just equally dishing out people like that, with no care about them, and a sort of symmetrical destiny. You know, which way shall I put this one? And Paul wants to show us that exactly isn't how God works in his potter's shop. He has the right, he's the potter, but that isn't how he operates, because he's not just powerful, he's also good. Now at this point, I want to be go into a bit of geeky grammar, and I apologize if you hated grammar at school, but I want to show you just how carefully the Bible chooses every single word. And because we've just got two paragraphs for today's sermon, we get the chance to go into it in even more detail than we'd often be able to. And I want you to notice two subtle ways in which Paul shows us that these two destinies, destruction or glory, are not symmetrical. That God doesn't intend both of them in the same way with equal pleasure. It's not as if God just goes, oh, one for heaven, one for hell. And you've got to pay attention, but they are asymmetrical. They are quite different in God's mind. The first one is the word in order to, the linking word in order to. So verse 22 is about people headed for destruction. Verse 23 is about people headed for mercy. But in between the two verses, isn't an and, some for destruction and some for mercy, but an in order to. Just look again. What if God, desiring to show his wrath, his anger, to make known his power, has endured with much patience vessels of wrath prepared for destruction, in order to make known the riches of his glory for vessels of mercy, which he's prepared for glory. What is God's ultimate purpose? It's not two statements with an and, it's two statements with an in order to. The purpose is verse 23. God wants to show his mercy. God shows his wrath in order to show his mercy. How does that work? God sends some to hell in order to show his mercy to some who he spares for heaven. Well, we've already had an example of it, and that was Pharaoh earlier, last week's passage, up in verse 17. Pharaoh, you might remember if you followed the story of Exodus, or you know the films about it. Pharaoh was the king of Egypt at the time when the Israelites were slaves, and he was absolutely stubborn-minded. And refused to let them go. And Moses went to Pharaoh and said, let my people go. God says, let my people go. And Pharaoh said, no, I'm not going to. And God hardened his heart so that he became very stubborn. Pharaoh became an object of God's wrath. Egypt was visited by God's terrible plagues. There were awful judgments against that country. God showed his strength and his power against Pharaoh. But what was the outcome of that? As we read on the Bible story, we discover that the reputation of God to be a powerful warrior spread far and wide. And people heard what had happened to Pharaoh, and they realized that God wasn't bluffing when he says there was going to be a real judgment. And we discover there's a lady called Rahab, who's living across the border in Canaan. She's a a pagan. She doesn't follow the true God. But she's heard about how powerful God is and how he smashes Pharaoh. And so in trembling, she turns to the real God and says, please show me mercy. I've heard that hell isn't, so you're not just bluffing when you talk about hell, that there really is punishment. And so I'm desperate for mercy, please. And Paul says that's what it's all for. Show some wrath in order to, ultimate purpose, to show others mercy. I guess there'll be some here who only fled to Jesus for salvation when it dawned on you that judgment wasn't an empty threat. God wasn't bluffing when he says there is a judgment day. And it woke you up. You thought, I need forgiveness before the day that I meet him on his judgment seat. And so that wrath was in order for mercy. So first thing, look at the linking word, in order to. The next one's even more geeky, and I apologize for this, as I say. But if you think back to your English lessons or whatever language you grew up with, lessons at school, you might have learned about something called the active and the passive voice. And if you haven't, we're going to do a little recap now. The active voice is, for example, Andrew kicked the cat. He's active because I was the person doing the kicking. That's an active voice. The passive voice was the cat was kicked. And the difference is the active voice emphasizes that I really was very active in it. The passive voice just tells things from the cat's perspective, I guess. The cat was kicked. I always remember this because when I was growing up in a little sleepy village church in Cambridgeshire, we had these confirmation classes. Unfortunately, they didn't tell us very much about the Christian message, which would have been a great help. But instead, lots about the church furniture and the shape of the building, all that kind of thing. And I remember a whole lesson about the brass in the church and how shiny it all had to be, etc. And I remember we were, I don't know, age 13 or 14, and we asked the vicar, oh, do you polish the brass then? And his answer, very tactfully, he said, certainly the brass is polished. That would be an example of a passive voice, okay? He doesn't emphasize his involvement in the polishing of the brass. In fact, I think it's pretty unlikely that it was him who polished it. Well, now you've got these categories. Just notice the asymmetry, okay? So you think it's going to be one for heaven, one for hell, you know, symmetrically. It's not. Look down at verse 22. What if God, desiring to show his wrath and to make known his power, has endured with much patience vessels of wrath prepared for destruction, passive voice, in order to make known the riches of his glory for vessels of mercy, which he has prepared for glory, active voice. You see, just the very, very subtly, in the verb that Paul uses, he emphasizes that God is more immediately active in destining, preparing some for glory, than he is in preparing some for destruction. Now, Paul isn't saying that God has nothing to do with the destruction, because he's the potter. He makes both lots of vessels. Ultimately, he has mercy on whom he wants, and he hardens whom he wants. So God is in charge of everyone's destiny. But he doesn't stand behind both destinies in the same way. He's asymmetrically, his ultimate purpose is the salvation, is the mercy of his people. So you see that we've got to combine two things. God is in charge of who goes to hell, as well as who goes to heaven. But it's people who are going to heaven, that's his ultimate purpose. Rescuing people is what makes him excited. That's what he's especially active in. Now, last part of the argument, or almost last part of the argument, over the page. Remember, what's more, that all of us deserve judgment, whether we be Jews or Gentiles, and yet God wants to show mercy to everyone, whether Jews or Gentiles. So look down at verse 24. So his purpose is to show the riches of his glory for vessels of mercy, even those whom he's called not only from the Jews, but also among the Gentiles. Now, this is very, very surprising. We'll see why as we read on. As he says in Hosea, those who are not my people, I call my people. Her who was not beloved, I call beloved. In the very place where it was said to them, you're not my people, there they'll be called sons of the living God. Now, then if you followed that first reading that Neil brought us, But it's basically a time in Israel's history when they've really stuffed up with God. And the way God describes it is quite shocking. He says to the prophet Hosea, go and marry a whore. Go and marry a woman of the night, you know, a prostitute. Because this country, this nation, has prostituted herself, has whored herself out to other gods. It's a very vivid image. What God is saying is, spiritually, Israel has been unfaithful to me. They've jumped into bed with somebody else, with another god. And as a powerful image of that, I want the prophet Hosea to go and see what that's like. Well, everyone knows that divorce is hardest on the children, and that's no exception, because Hosea has three children, and he's told to give them horrible names. The children are called Not My People, Not Loved, and No Mercy. Just imagine the school register. Andrew, yep. We had five Andrews in my class. It was just a trendy name in 1975. Andrew, yep. Peter, whatever, yep. Not My People, yeah. Not Mercy, yes. Not Loved. I mean, what a terrible name for a child to carry off to school. But it was a symbol of just where God's people deserve to be because they're adultery. But then amazingly, at the end of that very, very grim chapter in Hosea, they get their names changed. And God says, the one who was called Not My People, I'm going to call You Are My People. And the one who was called Not Loved, I'm going to call I Love You Very Much. And in the place where they were called Not My People, they're going to be called Sons of the Living God. Change the names. Even though they don't deserve mercy, give them mercy. Now that's an amazing turnaround for what the Jewish people deserve. And what's more, even people who were, you know, far, far away from God, who didn't even know God in the Old Testament, Gentiles, can get included as well. Sons of the Living God. And then Paul goes on to say, and don't forget that even though God promised, and this is again in Hosea, about the number of the sons of Israel being like the sand of the sea, only a tiny proportion of them were saved. That was last week's argument, if you were here. Not everyone, so my microphone's going funny. Not everyone descended from the people of Israel was one of God's people. Only a remnant, only a few remained faithful to him. And in fact, if it hadn't been for God's mercy, there would have been none. It would have been like Sodom and Gomorrah. Remember those two cities in the book of Genesis that were so wicked that God sent fire from heaven to obliterate them? And fire rained down and the city was entirely wiped out. That's what we should have had. That's what we deserved. But instead, God decided to preserve a remnant for himself. The future is in the hands of a God who is good. He's in charge, he's the potter, he has the right. But his character is not only powerful, but good. He chooses to use his power to show mercy to people who don't deserve it. To adopt as his children people who deserve to be cut off from him. To show mercy to those who don't deserve mercy. To love people who he doesn't deserve to love. And all of this, Paul says, magnifies the glory of his name. It was there in verse 17, just look up the top. God said to Pharaoh, what was the whole of the business of slavery in Egypt and all the plagues and Pharaoh's stubbornness? What was it all for? So that I might show my power and that my name might be proclaimed in all the earth. The God who doesn't bluff. The God who's a warrior. The God who will punish evil. The God who rolls up his sleeves for a fight. God wants everyone to know. But then verse 23, God wants to make known the riches of his glory through vessels of mercy. God's purpose in all of this, in the way he plans history, is that everyone will be able to see what a merciful God he is. Yes, some to hell, some to destruction, but others plucked out of that destiny by mercy showing the glory and the goodness of the God who is in charge. And so I hope you can say at the end of this passage, it's one of those bits that you might have wished wasn't in the Bible. I hope you can see it is a great bit of the Bible. I mean, all the Bible's great, isn't it? But the bit, sometimes you get books that are called the hard sayings of the Bible or the problem passages in the Bible. I think it's a, there aren't any problem passages in the Bible. There aren't any hard bits of the Bible. There's just bits where we're more wrong before we read them carefully. And I hope you now say, I'm so glad for Romans chapter 9. I'm so glad that God is in charge of my destiny, because the one who's powerful is also good. We're going to turn to pray in a moment.